accession number 28898, reel 12.
Matt Charlesworth, reel 12.
Got it.
So you're out in Iraq. How long were you out there for?
A year and a bit. A year and a half, I think it was. Then, as I said, tour of duty in Iraq. It was so hot, and it was just an airfield, 400 miles of desert in every direction, nothing to do.
You said you formed the aerobatics team actually out there.
Yeah.
So what would you do with the aerobatics team? What would you show? Would you display?
Well, no, not really. We just did it for our own amusement. But Pete Shaw is still a very great friend of mine. Has been ever since we left the RAF together. But he was sailing Charlie in this little four-man aerobatic team that I had to begin with, and I did one in front of the hangar building. That's where we're very situated, and I knew exactly what I was doing. I mean, I knew exactly how far around the loop I could go and where it would finish up. But he's sort of, if he's flying tailing Charlie, all you're doing is you're flying on the tail booms of the head. That's all you're looking at. You don't look at anything else. But you see when you're going over the top, because you see the ground turning into the upside down, and you're going the other way around, and you see the earth coming towards you through the aircraft ahead. And he thought he was going to plunge straight into the ground. And I think I've got 50-100 feet spare or something as he came out of the bottom of the loop. But when we got in, He threw his parachute in the corner. He said, "I'm never going to fly with you again, you bloody idiot. What the hell are you doing? You nearly killed me there. You nearly flew me to the ground." I said, "No, Pete, we had just an ordinary loop. We had exactly the same circumference as we normally do, and I'd got it taped off pretty well by then." He said, "You weren't going to hit the ground." But of course, I can see, no one meant. He was looking at the aircraft ahead, which was going straight down like that, and he wasn't looking at how close to the ground. He would see the ground rushing up towards him, and he couldn't pull through, get out of it. He was tucked up behind this fella here. So we came in a bit low on the ground. But, we just fought. Then we added more and more aircraft to it. I think we got up to about a seven-man team. No, we just did it for our own amusement. We used to go and have mock dog fighting with the Iraqis. It was King Idris. No, was it Idris? I can't remember. Not Idris. King, what am I? Can't think of his name now. The king is a kingdom then, and he bought some vampires from us. And he had the King's Squadron vampires, and they used to fly from an airfield closer to Baghdad. And we used to go across. When they were flying, we used to go across and dogfight with them. Of course, that's absolutely hopeless. They really were hopeless. They didn't know what they were doing. I think they just hated flying. It's just not in there. Makeup to be airborne in any aircraft, white knuckle. What am I doing? But they invited us across to the king invited us across, because it was his personal squadron, a bit like his bodyguard, to a formal dining in night with them. So we went across there in our bow ties and little monkey jackets and medals and things. And we went to this beautiful canopied sort of, I think it was a big tent-like thing, rugs on the floor, and a big table about that high going right down the centre. And we sat on cushions around this, cross-legged on cushions, great bowls of food everywhere, and the flowers and silver and stuff like that. Then the bowls of food delivered by the chaps was, waiters, and put down there, and it was a great steaming bowl of hot, and they had a plate of just hot food, and I thought, how the hell do we got those knives and water? How do we eat this? And we watched them, and we saw the king or something put his hand inside the thing and pulled something out, put it on his plate. So I thought, oh, that's a way to do it. It looked like a dead rat. You know, see what it was for hell. I thought, well, better eat it, I suppose. I eat it. It was absolutely red hot with spices and stuff. But to this day, we don't know what it was. Of course, no drinking, we were totally unused to. But to this day, I didn't know what we'd eaten, because they couldn't speak any English, of course, and we didn't have much conversation. We had, English pilot, Iraqi pilot, English pilot. So we thought we'd better return the compliment. And so we invited them to our place for dining at night. of course, we had different food. And also, we drank like mad. Basically, I couldn't drink because they were all Muslims. And we all got plastered, and they're looking at us in vain. And these fellas don't fly airplanes and get plastered, do they? What are they, what are they doing? but it was a nice touch. We had this swap for this thing. Then, what happened after that? I'd broken my wrist. I bashed it through the window, or knocked it through the window, or something, and broke it. Still the cut there. That little white mark there, that broke the wrist I had in plaster. I was getting near the end of my time anyway. So I left home in a Hastings. I think it was Hastings, yes. This is an engine aircraft. Then I became ADC to, my first ground job this was then, I became ADC to the AOC of a maintenance command group, lovely chap, Bertie Coombe, the Brewery family, Coombe and something, I can't remember what it was. I shouldn't say this about him really, or about his wife, but anyway, he was a very nice chap. But there were four groups in maintenance command, and I had an officer alongside his, and he used to call me and say, Maxwell, what am I supposed to be doing today? And I said, we're supposed to be visiting Santa Rocky, and I was a squadron leader then. The four groups, the maintenance command chief, he was an air marshal, four air marshal, a sir. When you get to air marshal, you're knighted. It's an automatic thing. And it's a great thing, you know, you're a sir and lady for the rest of your lives, right through retirement till you die. And the four groups in maintenance command, and Bertie Coombe, whose group I was in, was by far the most competent of the group commanders. He was the only one with pilot's wings, all the others were engineers, all air vice marshals. And we were convinced that when the air marshal retired, that he would get the job. Everybody, all the other group commanders thought he would, the whole world thought he would. And stat me, when a day came to it, some other group commander, who was awful, an ex-engineer officer who'd never flown an airplane in his life, and he got the job. And Verdicum was late coming in that morning when it was announced. I heard him stomping about in his office. I went up to the door, I said, are you all right, sir? He said, oh, I'm bloody not all right. So I said, what's going on? He said, well, I haven't got that job. He said, I'm going to retire. He said, I've all worked all my life, and I'm now discarded. I said, terrible, I've never done anything like it. Just totally unfair. So I said, sir, you know, when a sergeant gets, he said, ruined my RF career. I said, when a sergeant gets promoted to flight sergeant, he thinks that's a tremendous feat. He's really over the moon about that. I said, and you say you haven't had a career. You are an air vice marshal. That is a very high-ranking officer. You'd have been an air marshal if you got the job. I said, you can't say you haven't been a successful air vice marshal. I think I've been terribly successful. He said, oh, no, I should be an air marshal. But it's all relevant, isn't it? Wherever you are, if you go one up, you've done well. Promoted one rank up, he'd done well. And he just missed that one out. An important one. But he retired then. But his wife, she liked her booze. And she used to ring me up and say, look, Max, will you bring a crate of gin up to my residence? I'd say, well, okay, yeah, but I'm not supposed to do it, I'll do it. So I go out to our bar and I get a crate of gin. So it's for her marshal's wife. So I just go out, put it in the back of my car, go around there. And there she'd be in a sort of silk dressing gown. I said, have a gin, Max. I said, oh, it's 11 o'clock in the morning, I can't have a gin here. If I'm caught here by the air marshal, I'll kick out of the RAF. She said, what is it? Well, you don't want to anybody. She said, sit down and have a gin. I said, I can't do it, can't do it. Anyway, so there you are, there's your gin. Now I disappear off. But she used to get absolutely stoned. And eventually she got me and he said, Max, I understand you've been taking the odd gin up to my wife. He said, would you please not do that in the future? Dennis could seem to be doing that sort of thing. I said, well, okay, so I won't do it. And then she used to ring me up. I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't do it. But he said, my son's having a leaving school dance, and it's very high powered. There's lots of, you know, sheriff of the county's daughter is going to be there and all this sort of thing. He said, could you host the party for me, Max, all these young people? And he said, I won't be attending, I'll be away to a meeting in town, but my wife will be there, and of course, keeping an eye on things. And it was a dinner jacket thing, all these young fellows in dinner jackets, and all these girls in debutantes or ball gowns. And then Herr Marshall's wife came down the stairs. She was hanging out with the banister. She was a lovely looking woman, really nice figure and everything. Came down the banister, hanging out with the banister, came down, she walked across to me. Oh, Max, I'm so glad you're here. He said, would you care to have a dance with me? I said, well, it's nice. It's a nice, supple body. And I suddenly realised that she was as drunk as an owl. I couldn't keep her upright. And suddenly we crashed to the ground in the middle of the dance floor. There I was on the floor with the Air Marshal's wife and I was all. And trying to get her back up to her feet again. Everybody stopped and stared. So I was all around, rushed around the place and managed to get her home somehow. Got her driver to take her home. But I really shouldn't have mentioned that because that's because, you know, I'm mentioning somebody's wife there who's, they won't be alive now because they're older than I was. So then after that, I was sent to Canberra training school.
How long did you do the job for?
That was about a 2-year job.
So are we looking about 54 now, something like that?
Yes. In fact, beginning of 55, I was sent to Bassingmore to train on Canberras. I'd never known anything about Canberras before. They were big aircraft, big twin engine bombers, and I went down to Bassingmore and went through the whole thing there. And I'd never flown with a crew before. And now I was going to have a permanent navigator. So pilots did their training separately. And then navigators did their navigation training. It's a non-flying place, or flew around somewhere, I suppose, to get used to instrumentation and radar stuff they had to use, but not on cameras. But eventually, after getting used to flying this thing, having done a bit of flying with the instructor, it was time to meet up and select a crew member. So we all gathered in the mess, all the navigators and all the pilots, first time gathered in the mess. And we got chatting over a few drinks, and people selected who they felt compatible with. They said, well, would you like to be my navigator, or can I be your pilot, or whatever? And I said, it's all couples walking out, sort of disappearing off, and fewer and fewer people there. Eventually, there were two of us left in this room. I was looking out the window, and this fellow, Kenaton, there he was. He was done a couple of tours on various aircraft as a navigator. And I'd done lots of tours because I've got decorations and things, and these are all just post-war people. And I said, what's your name? He said, Kenaton, what's yours? I said, Max Charleswell. I said, well, the only two left, Ken, we'd better join up together, I suppose. So we did do. But one problem with Ken is he hated flying. He absolutely hated it. Now, the first solo flight I did with a camera with him, I had to go solo eventually, this camera. And it was quite complicated. It made by English Electric. Everything was electrically driven. He had a million switches all around the place. Little alternator bubbles came, either went white when they were on, black when they were off. The whole thing was just automated. So we got everyone to say, ready, okay, off we go. Took off. Just got into cloud. It was a sort of layer of cloud about 2,000 feet thick. When, onto instruments, see straight away, and flying through cloud, when suddenly two of the alternators went white. And my artificial horizon, on which I was flying to keep the wings level, suddenly spun around. And the oil pressure on that engine suddenly went. And I thought, Christ, I've got an engine failure. My first flight, because there was a single engine, climb through the cloud, then land. So I called up base right away. I said, I've got a problem. I'm in cloud at the moment, climbing up on a single engine. One of my engines has failed. I said, are you okay, Ken? He said, yeah, I'm all right, Max. Because I couldn't see him. He was behind me, behind a sort of navigating thing area with radar screen and everything. And I said, well, it was very difficult. Flying on a single engine, you've got to trim it because you get asymmetric. You've got to trim it out. And remember, you've got to use a lot more power on the single engine. And well, I didn't have proper instruments. I had to fly on a turn and bank on a very limited instrument panel. And broke the top of the cloud. I thought, oh, Christ, that. I said, can you give me a steer back to base? So they gave me a steer. I said, I'm a single engine, my solo flight. And I said, one of my engines has gone. So I said, I've got lots of electrical problems too. So I hope the radio doesn't go. Because I didn't know what, I just didn't know what had happened. It went down, came in, and dropped down through the cloud again, and came in. It had long flight, and got a single engine, you know, you've got to be pretty careful. You haven't got a lot of power to play with it. So I suppose it. I came in a single engine, got down okay, landed it, and it wouldn't taxi on a single engine because it slewed it, so I think it had to be towed in. I left it at the end of the runway, it had to be towed in by a tractor. And I gave it to the senior engineer officer. I said, I don't know what happened. I said, those two lights came on, those two alternator lights came on, my instruments all went haywire. I described what had happened and said, my left engine just went. And so, it seems to have some major electrical failure. Anyway, we'll check it out and tell you what it was. So I was a bit winded about that. I thought, oh, Christ, first solo, single engine, engines, all instruments going on, haywire, climbing through cloud. And just senior engineer officer came and saw me in the mess that night and said, oh, Max, aircraft, we've been through the fine tooth comb, we can't find anything wrong with it. We've done all the tests on all the electrics, everything. Fired up the engines, they go very smoothly. We just don't know what it was. I thought, it was something. Why would the engine fail? Why did my instruments all topple? And anyway, it was something else. He said, well, I'll have another look at it. And I just went into the distance because I was flying every day, you know. And oh, when I was into Germany, eventually posted to Germany, under the first B-8s, they had a sleek cockpit hood, like a fighter hood, and they were in interdiction of all black. They were nuclear bomb carriers, and they had rockets and special long range tanks and four cannons and a gun pack underneath.
Can you give me a sort of thumbnail sketch of the Canberra, as an aircraft as you remember it most at that stage?
It's very, very nice, very, very comfortable to fly. It was built as a high altitude bomber, and we were going to use it in an interdiction role in Germany. There's three or four squadrons of them, low level role. And it was very heavy on the controls because the wing loading was very high, a very big wingspan to cope with high level flying. And it wasn't designed to fly low level, so the wing loading was a bit heavy. But very nice airplane to fly, very reliable.
Was it a two-man aircraft?
Yes, you had a navigator, always had a navigator, or two navigators, but always a navigator. And he was in a Canberra B-8, very different from all the other marks of Canberra. You had to climb up, the pilot had to get in, climb up, and get into his cockpit because you were looking over the top. I've got a photograph of me flying one actually here. In the main role, we were going out there to do a low altitude bombing system with nuclear weapons. So I had a nuclear bomb in the bomb bay, which was designed to carry a nuclear bomb, and we delivered it by flying very low and very, very fast as a camera would go without getting into compressibility. That's about Mark 8.87, something like that. Low level, 470 knots, something of that order. Over an identification point, something that we could identify on the map, then setting a certain course from that point. Worked out beforehand, you had to feed in the barometric pressure of the air in that area. Wind speed and direction, you know, lots of different things you had to feed into it. And we flew at a certain exact speed from that point for an exact distance of time on instruments the whole way, and then you pull 4G, well, it starts to go up, and at 40 degrees the bomb would automatically release and be thrown forward, and then we would continue on instruments to go over the top, right over and up at about 6,000-7,000 feet, and you go down and then roll out and flat out hit the deck again and get away. Now the idea was it was throw the bomb about a mile or a mile and a half ahead. We would be going away at high speed. The theory was that we would be out of the way of the bomb explosion when it went off, nuclear weapon. We were never quite sure about this. We had special goggles pulled down and some sort of shield pulled down to stop the blast making us not able to see our instruments for a while. But it was, we often wondered how this would work. But we practiced with practice bombs. We got quite good at lobbing these bombs a mile and a half ahead. But you had to fly extremely accurately, and the difficulty in this thing was that you were flying a big aircraft and doing a loop in it at high speed, and all on instruments, because whether it was cloud or night, you were on instruments all the way through this maneuver, and you waited until the gyroscope, autopilot thing, showed that you're in a 25 degree dive, and you leveled off of that, and you full bore to the ground away. And eventually we were issued a target, and our target was somewhere northeast Poland, northeast Poland, or some great, some area where the troops marshalled. It was a big barrack area full of troops and tanks and things. And the whole idea is that we would go in first, if war broke out, we would be first in to knock out their radars, troop concentrations, railway yards, anything that stopped their troop movements coming westward into Europe. And but I just say to Ken, look, Ken, we'll work out, we're low level all the way until you got to a certain point when we had to pull up to get the range. You can't get any range low level in a jet. It uses fuel like mad, so you climb it to 45,000 feet for the last part of the journey, hope that their fighters wouldn't hit us in time. Then, when we're getting near the IP point, down again, run it, accelerate it up to the IP, up to the target, lob the bomb, climb, come back low level for a while, then climb up as high as you could get, and cruise climb home, using as little fuel as possible. Cruise climb, incidentally, is when you get to a certain height in the camber, about 45,000 feet, using the most economical power setting you had on the throttles. And then you stayed at that height until as you burned off fuel, the aircraft got lighter, and it climbed automatically, just keeping a controlled column steady and everything else. It would just climb, find its own height, and you'd get up to 50,000 feet in a camber, no problem. And then hope we get home. And I said, Ken, look, let's work this out carefully. Get yourself sorted out, the navigation system sorted out, so that we can get back. And he did all sorts of combinations of low highs and high lows and things. He said, Max, we're not going to get back from this, you know, that day. I said, well, if you tell me so, I suppose you're right, but try and work it out so that we can. He said, no, I've tried all sorts of combinations, Max, and it's a non-return flight. So that was very cheering, but I thought to myself, well, we're first in, and I suppose we're just sacrificial lambs, you know, one or two. Some could get back, others couldn't. Mine was a very far one. And we were just on readiness at the end of the runway, and if the alarm went, we were off. The alarm often used to go, but they were practice alarms. You know, it would be night, in marriage court, I'd be in bed at night. Horn would go, hood would go, and I'd have to dash down to the aircraft. To get aboard, Ken would have to set up a bomb, or he had all sorts of systems he had to do on the bomb. Then we'd have to take off, it, well, no matter what the weather was, and start flying towards the East German border. And then we'd get a signal that it was not on, and so we'd turn back. But we never knew. We never knew when we went off whether it was the actual alarm or not. It was in the days when the the tension was the highest. It was the sort of days when Kennedy was loggerheads with the Russians about their rockets in Cuba. And it was, you know, in fact, an American told me that. He said, well, we're going to do a strike on Russia if this goes on. So we didn't, you know, it was a very tense situation, the Cold War.
What was the squadron that you joined?
The first one in Germany, 88 Squadron, Wildenrauf. Then I started 16 Squadron. I was sent up to Lahrbruck, slightly north of Wildenrauf, and started another squadron called 16 Squadron. I built that up.
That's still with the same role, Max?
So it's the same role. But it meant, you see, this readiness system meant that we couldn't be off the base for... We could only be off the base one weekend in a month. Because we were always on either total readiness, that's when you're sitting in the cockpit, or half an hour's readiness, or some sort of readiness. And so we had to be around for three of the weekends of the month, or we could get off at one weekend. But it was a very tense period. We used to do a lot of training. We were constantly doing these dog-leg flights and things in all sorts of weather. But one of those flights, interestingly enough, it was a very... we used to fly in awful weather. We learned to fly. We were all master green. That's an instrument rating. It's the highest rating you can get for flying in the worst possible landing conditions, which meant a 300-foot cloud base and 1,500 yards visibility, which was not very good. But this particular night, I took off straight into cloud, climbed up 40,000 feet. Now, my circuit, practice flight this was to climb up, fly high level to the Outer Hebrides, then right across the North Sea to Heligoland, and drop down to bomb some imaginary target in the peninsula that goes up, what's it called, on the German coast, and then after doing that, climb up again and fly back down to Lahrbruck. And I got to this place way up above cloud. The cloud tops were 40,000 feet. It was really a grim day. You'd see lightning flashing over the cloud tops from underneath it, and turn starboard to get down to low fly. I wanted to be at a low level at Heligoland. So I throttled back, went into a glide, into the cloud, down I went. And, St. Elmo's fire, I'd never seen that before. When the whole of the inside of the cockpit suddenly lights up with green flashes of, like a television screen, green flashes all around the cockpit of electricity. And it's a bit dazzling, and you're coming down on instruments, of course, the whole time. And I said, okay, now, make sure you've got us right, because we set the barometric pressure at base, and I'm going to go down to 400, 500 feet here, so just make sure that you've got us right or we'll fly into the sea. So the barometric pressure, you see, affects the altimeter. And if you don't have it set right for where you are, then you're never the right distance above ground. And it can vary quite a bit. He said, yeah, I've got it right, Matt. I've got a Heligoland barometric pressure. Okay. So down. Still hadn't broken cloud, still fully throttled back. A sort of steep glide. Right across the North Sea in this steep glide. And I got lower and lower. I thought, Christ, I was rather hoping the weather might be a bit better there. But we got down, and I said, are you sure about this? Can you got the barometric? I said, I'm going down to 1,500. I want to drop down to 1,000 feet now. And still in clouds, 1,000 feet. And I said, well, I'm not going much lower than this. I said, I'm going to give you this height because I don't know where we are really. I hadn't seen the ground since we'd taken off. And I said, Ken was not much brilliant. No, anyway. So he quite sure. I said, yeah, okay. Suddenly, I saw a great flash of light on my starboard side. And I thought, Christ, that's Heligoland. I'm flying at an angle. I'm flying on the side. That's Heligoland. And I looked right. I thought this cloud had just broken, but there were the lights of Heligoland. Looked right. And there's a great stream of flame coming out of my starboard engine. It was on fire. And it was absolutely rushing back. So I said, Ken, Christ, we've got the starboard engine on fire, Ken, we're in cloud. And I said, get prepared to bail out. And I immediately flame that engine out, press the extinguisher, which was carbon dioxide extinguisher,